award in CB Menon gold medal. And Dr. Bhargava, it is our indeed great honor to have your colloquium today here, and I invite you to deliver the talk. Thank you very much.
Yeah, this is forward and backward. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Satyanarayan. Thank you very much. So my the aim of my interaction today is essentially to draw some parallels between the act of observation and how it has enriched the thought process in quantum physics. And there has been a kind of a uncertainty or a dilemma that whatever happens at that small particle level, either at no weight or hardly any weight, to the macro level, is that applicable? And obviously we know that looking at a cat somewhere or looking at a building somewhere, nothing changes in that cat, nothing changes in that building. But does that happen at some other macroscopic level? So I'll try and draw some parallels and try and see if they are of any use in clinical sciences. So let me quickly recapitulate the act of observation, variously termed as the Copenhagen interpretation or Schrodinger's cat, various ways in which things have been spoken about. But essentially it states that the state of what's being observed remains unpredictable, or if there are multiple possibilities, then those multiple possibilities remain superimposed. For example, cat being dead or alive, that both are the possibility, that cat is also dead and also alive. So when not observed, so when you're not looking at it, you don't know what's happening and whether that point exists there, in what capacity, in what state, is completely unknown. When the observation happens, this state, multiplicity of states, collapses into some single state. What are the determinants of that will be outside the field of this discussion, but that they would find itself, that the process would find itself in one of these superimposed positions. In cancer, what remains in a state of flux is whether the tumor has left its primary organ and has gone somewhere else. This is such a big difference. It's the difference between being alive at the end of 5 years or not being alive at the end of 5 years. Because if the primary tumor has left its organ of origin and has seeded itself somewhere else, the possibility of cure with the best of the treatment across the globe is zero. I'm talking about solid tumors. Please exclude leukemias and lymphomas from this discussion, because those are different kinds of tumors. They do not follow these principles. They are at inception. They are widespread. They are everywhere. Since they start in blood, their primary origin itself being blood, they are everywhere in the body. Whereas a solid tumor that originates in any organ is essentially confined to its organ till quite late. Somewhere down the line, it spreads to some other organ, and that, when it happens, the chance of cure are gone. They don't exist. If I have investigationally detectable cancer outside the primary organ, when I say primary organ, suppose if it's breast, I'm talking about breast and the lymph node, which is the first basin, a filter where everything gets trapped. Till the time it is confined to these areas, the cure is still there. The moment it leaves these two areas, goes somewhere else, the cure is lost. One can't get rid of that disease. So what is important is that we have had all kinds of investigations done in vitro, in vivo, ex vivo, so many experimental animal studies, all of them tell me how does, what is it in primary tumor that allows cells to go somewhere else and seed themselves, colonize themselves and produce a secondary tumor. All that is known. If you ask, there will be, if I put a PubMed query on a process of metastasis, I will have something that I won't be able to finish reading till the time, the end of my life probably. That much of studies have gone into it. What has been extremely difficult for us in clinic is to understand when has it happened. The timing, when does metastasis set in, is what is not fully understood. And we are sometimes, when I look at the survival figures, and I find that this truth is staring at us almost like the first verse of the 15th chapter in Gita, Urdhvamula Adhishakam Ashwatham Prahurabhyam Chandamsi Yasya Paranani Yastam Veda Savedavit. That the uncertainty is staring at us, because the uncertainty tree is an inverted tree. The roots are right in front, the causes are right in front of us, but we are so fond of digging in that we dig in. And what we get while digging are beautiful branches, beautiful leaves, beautiful flowers, maybe some fruits, but they are useless. The roots are staring at us. So the huge amount of data in front of us, but we don't know how to use them. So do these superimposed states, the question that I'm asking, commit to one by the act of observation. Surgery, I'm a surgeon and I'm talking as if, am I the culprit? So let's look at our first experiment. Now, I'm going to take you in retrospect. Our last experiment, the recent ones. This is unpublished data. This is just being prepared at the moment to be sent to Nature Medicine. Right. So this experiment essentially looks at what happens during surgical intervention. So what I have done, let me describe what happens during surgical intervention. A tumor well within the organ, since I'm a breast cancer specialist, I'll be talking about the experiment being done in breast cancer patients. So completely vascularized, well fed by nutrition, as far as nutrition goes through blood supply, is what the state of the tumor is before I make my first incision on the skin. Post incision, I start devascularizing the tumor. So loss of nutrition, loss of oxygenation, graded loss of both these happens as I denude the tumor on all sides. And then finally, the tumor is in my hand. Has no blood supply, has no nutritional support. So it is, I would call this normoxic, normal oxygenation. Hypoxic, this would be various grades of hypoxia from here till the tumor is in my hand, when it is completely anoxic. It has no oxygenation at all. And this process, in good surgical hand, from 0 to 30 minutes. In 25 to 30 minutes, the tumor is in my hand. Slightly slow surgeon, it might take 40 minutes to an hour, but within an hour, everything is over. The tumor is completely devascularized. So what we did is, we did a core biopsy, which is a core of tissue, which is about an inch and about 3 to 4 millimeters in thickness. And I've taken two or three cores of the primary tumor when the tumor is completely vascularized, and it is kept in RNA later, so that whatever state it is in its expression, that's frozen at that time. Somewhere down the line, when 50 to 70% of the circumference of that sphere that holds the tumor is completely denuded. So my incision would be about a centimeter away from the primary tumor, cutting all the blood vessels that supply the primary tumor. And if more than 50% to 70% of this surface, once it is denuded, I do again 3 or 4 core biopsies. So I have a second sample of the same tumor that's taken while this happens. And then when the whole tumor is in my hand, I again take core biopsies. So I have 3 sets of core biopsies. One completely vascularized normoxic tumor, the second hypoxic tumor, and that hypoxic tumor might be in various grades of hypoxia, and the third component is completely anoxic tumor. So these 3 tumors, what is variable is there may be a state of hypoxia which is variable at point zero, that I don't know what it is, but some tumors are hypoxic to begin with, and there is a gradation of hypoxia, but that's a chronic hypoxia. That's a hypoxia that has happened over a period of year, 2 years, 3 years. So it's a chronic hypoxia that might have happened, and the degree of chronic hypoxia is unknown to me at the moment. I will get to know about it only when I study the expression profile of 0.0. Yeah? So I have these 3 sets of tumors samplings that has happened. We use the on the NGS platform HiSeq, we have about 30 million paired and reads per sample of RNA that is looked at, and I have, now there will be some difference in numbers here. We started off with 8 tumors here, 8 tumors there, and 8 tumors there. But I am also running another experiment wherein something has been given in between to modulate this hypoxia response, but the zero sample remains zero sample. It's the same. So there are about 32 tumors at point A, and there are about 8 patients with triplicates. That means out of these 32, over and above these 32, there are 8 tumors which are in triplicates at point A, B, and C. Point A, point B, and point C. So I have about 40 tumor samples at point A, about 7 tumor samples and 1 normal at point B, and 7 tumor samples and 1 normal at point C. In addition to that, if this I make a consider as test set, there are about 20 triplets that are already being collected without any intervention, exactly like this, and that will be the validation set that we are presently experimenting at the moment in the wet lab.
But
meant by
normal?
Normal is surrounding normal breast tissue.
There's no tumor there.
There's no tumor there. But I always have some margin of normal tissue when I'm removing the tumor. I don't get into the tumor. The principle of cancer surgery is not to see the primary tumor. If I see the primary tumor, that means I have violated the principle of surgery. Surgery entails removal of tumor with its normal tissue coverings around it, because there is always some microscopic spread within the normal tissue, and I don't want any of the tumor to be left behind, because that will be failure of my surgery. So surrounding normal tissue also undergoes the same kind of devascularization. The purpose was to find out whether that also responds similar to the primary tumor. So what do we expect? As the surgical procedure progresses, the magnitude of observation also increases. By that I mean deprivation of oxygenation and deprivation of nutrition. In between state A, which is normoxic, and state C, which is anoxic, a graded change of hypoxia should occur, where I anticipate, quite like a fight that one undergoes in a not so good part of the city. Suppose you have landed somewhere and you suddenly find that you have been attacked, there would be a fright response. You would resist. And at any given time, if you find that this is a losing battle, you might want to run away. Flight. That's the usual response. I expect the same kind of response, assuming that this is a live organism that is trying to live within an environment which is hostile to it. In stage C, complete anoxia, I anticipate that there would be complete withdrawal of these responses because it's a lost battle. The tumor has nothing to do there. It cannot any further resist because it doesn't have the raw material to replenish whatever has been utilized for various purposes. So it will try to be as conservative as possible and will withdraw all kinds of responses. What is unfortunate is for the last 100 years of our understanding of cancer has been only from sample A or sample C. There have been no studies of sample B ever in medical literature. Sample B rather, the middle sample. And what do we find? I will just give you a succinct summary of those terabytes and terabytes of data. That's another difficulty. You know, as a clinician, we are used to looking at, say, 20 variables against 5 variables. And here we have some 100 variables across and 24,000 genes going either up, down, changing. And if I have 3 samples, there may be no consistent change all throughout. I might find that it has changed in 50% of the tumors. Then if I put a threshold, so without any thresholds, over 2000 genes have been dysregulated between point A and B. What surprises me enormously that we feel that DNA is such a solid structure that it will not get affected by anything, but I find that it is an extremely sentient structure. Sentient to every small change that is happening, and it is just not sentiency that it is receiving, it is also reacting. So 2000 genes up and down, if I were to look at 1.5 times increase on a log scale, and that's the threshold I use, and I want to find these changes consistently in all 3 states, 3 samples, if I use that strict criteria, then I have exclusively 41 genes which have changed between A and B, another 52 between B and C, but between A and C, I find that the numbers shrink. There are just about 11 of them, majority metabolic or corticosteroid related pathways, which are permissive pathways, the protective parts of the body. Any major stress as it rises, even in living organism, trauma, sepsis, wherein the life is threatened, the only reaction which is consistent is glucocorticoid response. That's a permissive and protective hormone that tries to give the semblance of equanimity to reduce majority of the things that are happening around us. A great number of these are upregulated genes are here. If you ask me, each of them, they can be on various pathways. Similarly, downregulated are there. I'm just giving you some examples of those. If we run the same analysis for various pathways, within various pathways, yeah. Okay, so by that I mean either overexpressed, that is upregulated. Deregulated means either upregulated or downregulated, either of these. That means if the signal at point A was X, the signal would be 2X, and I will call it in point B, and I would call it upregulated. That means it's lighting up to the extent that it is expressing much more strongly in my second specimen versus the first specimen. If my second specimen has reduction in its expression, then I would call it downregulated. So it's just the expression whether that much of mRNA is there or not. Yeah.
If you had taken out this tissue not from a tumor but from some other part of the body, would the same genes be affected? Because this primarily could be a response to hypoxia.
Yes, and I'm saying that. I want to say that. Yeah.
Is that pool of upregulated and downregulated genes common for all the 3 conditions?
This is again consistently. So what has happened is that these genes have been upregulated at all three points, from this point to that, from that point to that. And these are also exactly the same, that they've changed in all three points. If they're only in two points, they're not mentioned there. If I were to look at some of the pathways wherein some nodes on those pathways light up, and this is without a threshold, I'm not using any threshold, I'm just trying to say that there are some softwares. One of the softwares is called Pathologist. Now this software looks at even slightest increase in overexpression or underexpression, its effect on that pathway, and if there are multiple nodes on that pathway, some weightage given to that, and if there are multiple changes on that pathway, then all those get multiplied, and if there is a black box on that pathway, then changes in that are given much more weightage, and I get a score. And then I understand that overall, this pathway is majorly affected or not affected. If I use that software, then I get to know that the TNF-alpha through NF-kappa-B is the largest affected pathway. EMT, epithelial mesenchymal transition, an expression that bestows metastatic potential onto primary tumor. The tumor is completely epithelial, but phenotypically the cell shows everything to say that this is a mesenchymal cell. Mesenchymal cell is a resistant cell. It's a cell that cannot be killed so easily, like a fibroblast. A cell that is not so sensitive to radiation also. So all kinds of assaults, the ability of the cell to withstand those assaults is fantastically good. And then estrogen response pathways, whether late or early response pathways, were also upregulated. What was also known, that hypoxia pathway would be upregulated. Some growth pathways also were upregulated. So in general, we find that there is change as far as proliferation is concerned in some. A lot of invasion pathways were up, motility pathways were up, the EMT pathway was up. All this essentially bestows the metastatic phenotype on primary tumor cells. These are prognostic factors, known prognostic factors for metastasis in chronic state, whether I collect a biopsy at point A or point B. But they were no more there in great majority of point C specimens. I don't find the number of individuals with that. Yes. Say that again. No, these comparisons are between A and B, between B and C, and between A and C. The same tumor sample. That the tumor did not have this potential in sample A. It has come in B and it has disappeared in C. And all my understanding of tumor biology today has been in A and C. I have no insight on B at all. Yeah. So we did have, and the since the number is only one, we have not been able to conclude majorly, but not all these pathways are upregulated in normal pathways, in normal tissue. It hasn't happened. But in the next set of 20 triplets, in addition to that, I have five triplets of normal tissue for me to understand whether the responses in normal tissues are the same as those in tumors. Hypoxia induced normal tissue. Yeah, that's what I'm looking at. So, and the microenvironment having inflammatory response, microenvironment having permissive immunological responses, these are also something that could favor the metastatic potential. Now, let's first understand, I will take you from here on to the clinical aspects. Let's first understand that host is threatened only by the process of metastasis. In absence of metastasis, if I extirpate the tumor, it's a curative surgery. So it's vital, presence or absence of metastasis. So whatever I presented just now, how does this affect our understanding of the natural history of early breast cancer? Can this be extrapolated to the timing onset of autonomy of metastasis? And does act of observation during surgery change the natural history of disease? Now, surgery versus no surgery will be completely unethical. I won't be able to run that kind of study ever. So how do I prove whether there is a beneficial effect of surgery or is there a detrimental effect of surgery? How do I prove that? There is just no way I can prove it except in a situation which is the second best opportunity to understand and compare is within the tenets of screening trials. And let me explain to you what exactly do I mean. Screening is a very attractive proposition. If you are told that instead of a 5 centimeter tumor, I am going to pick up a 0.5 centimeter tumor and the chance of cure is going to increase from something like 30% to 95%, who doesn't want cure? So, vitally important that early detection is important and screening does lead to early detection. So, where is the problem? If I were to detect every tumor early, I would cure a lot more. But in biological systems, we need to have robust evidence that there is one set of tests that gives me certain degree of detection and there is another set of tests that has a greater precision of detection, then I need to compare these two. Compare these two in a randomized setting. Randomized trials are ruthless in eliminating biases. So let's look at what are the premises of randomized trial, screening trial. Typically, the basic assumption of such a randomized trial, when I randomize large number of normal women, I am talking about breast cancer. If it is colon cancer, if it is lung cancer, then colon cancer majority of the time it is men. Lung cancer, it is in smokers. In India it would be men majority. In the West it could be men, women, either of them. So what is the assumption? I have a 50,000 individuals here and 50,000 individuals here randomly allocated. When there is randomization of 100,000 individuals, usually in all characteristics they are identical. In what way should they be identical? Their risk factors, their all kinds of things are identical when such large numbers are randomized. The assumption is that there are X number of early tumors and there are Y number of late tumors on both sides. So the total kitty of tumors is X plus Y here and X plus Y there. I want you to remember this, what I am saying here. I will reiterate it later on to see the impact of the act of observation, screening, what happens. Due to my early detection or better detection in screening, all are treated. X is treated early because the screening test has the capability of picking up tumors early, and late are as it is manifest. So I am going to treat X plus Y in early years, say plus 3 or 4 years. On this side, I am not using this test. So I will treat only Y. I will allow X number of tumors to grow up to Y level, and then as they grow, they will be treated later. Is that clear? So, if I were to look at early years, all treated versus some treated, I can compare surgery in all versus surgery in some. So, no surgery versus surgery can be treated, can be compared here. Somewhere down the line, majority treated early and majority treated late. So early surgery versus late surgery. What I want to compare, that is early detection saving lives. So what do I anticipate? Let me give you some understanding of what the clinical assumptions are or teachings are. The standard teaching today is that micrometastases predate clinical diagnosis. That's what we have been taught. And I have not written all the sentence of that presumption from Fisher's hypothesis. It says that micrometastases predate clinical diagnosis and they are undetectable by present set of tests. So I hate when the assumption cannot be questioned. So it's been very clearly said that they are not detectable by any test. So if they are not detectable, what kind of question can I ask? Do they exist? Don't they exist? So that question is kind of eliminated, that cannot be detected. So I have to just assume 10% have it, 20% have it, 30% have it. But I don't have any way of knowing that, is there any way of detecting it at this juncture to confirm whether this is there or not? So a question like received knowledge. An event of loco-regional treatment does not impact on the behavior of this micrometastases. So if you remove, nothing happens. What I am trying to test here, that my removal, does it change the tumor? So both those were part of our teaching, the conventional wisdom. Whereas what I believe, that surgery either induces or bestows autonomy on these micrometastases that are there outside, or if they are not there, then it actually induces these metastases. Now, the difference is only one. The first presumption says that there are micrometastases unaffected by surgery. So, event of surgery is not going to affect the behavior of that micrometastasis, whereas the lower hypothesis says that it is actually produced at that time and it will grow. It will grow the way it is supposed to grow. So, what do I anticipate in the trials that I mentioned earlier in this trial? All treated versus some treated, and all treated early and all treated late. So three things to be remembered on this slide. The total kit is X plus Y on both sides. All treated versus some treated, all treated early versus all treated late. Now let's see, as per the Fisher paradigm, there should be equal mortality in the first few years of comparison of surgery versus no surgery. Whereas SDA hypothesis would say there would be an excess mortality in the screen side because I have induced metastasis which I am not inducing in the other group. When it comes to the late mortality, majority treated early versus majority treated late. Early surgery versus late surgery should save lives. So both paradigms will tell me that lives are saved. So let's see, what do I see? The difference is only here, that there should be equal mortality as per the conventional paradigm. By this new paradigm, there should be an excess mortality. Let's look at what happens. Slightly busy slide, I'm sorry. But essentially, read only one column at a time. There are various trials of less than 50, more than 50 years of age at presentation, randomized trials, and this number essentially is a ratio of mortality in the screen versus control arm. So if this ratio is more than 1, it means excess mortality in the screen arm. If it is less than 1, it means saving of lives in the screen arm. So let's look at first few years. You see this first 5 years, whether this and the first year here, in each of these the number is more than 1, indicating in all trials put together, 7 randomized trials of screening for breast cancer, all trials show an excess mortality in the first 5 years. To the extent, if you look at a publication that appeared in 2002, Annals of Internal Medicine, there are two papers that came in. the task force for screening from United States and the Canadian national trial of breast cancer screening. And the x-axis in the task force starts at year 5, and in the Canadian it starts at 0. So the first 4 years of data is not published by the US task force. Either it's a design or accident. So that's about breast cancer. So there have been screening trials for breast, lung, cervical cancer, that's our trial, prostate cancer. Multitudes of trials, there are 8 plus 6 plus 1 plus 3. So many trials of screening have happened for solid tumors. Let's look at what has happened. There is not, suffice to say that there is not a single trial that doesn't have excess mortality in the screened arm in the first few years. There is not a single trial. All trials have that, without exception. I'll just give you some examples. This is New England Journal of Medicine 2009, US study on prostate cancer. The black line is screening arm, and these are number of deaths. The red line is the control arm. So number of deaths are more all throughout till the time the trial was published at 10 years, and there is less mortality in the control arm. This looks at incidence. I mentioned to you that in the screened arm, X plus Y will be treated early. So there should be excess numbers, which are evident here. In the screened arm, there are excess numbers. But somewhere down the line, at 10 years, 15 years, X and Y should be treated on both sides. So this, what is anticipated is that these two lines should come together by 10th year or so. We now have data for colon cancer at 15 years, lung cancer at 15 years, breast cancer at 25 years, and the lines have not yet met. So we'll talk about it a bit later. Suffice to say about that incidence, but excess mortality, one, prostate cancer, breast cancer I already showed you, lung cancer, intervention arm as the screen arm, usual care control arm, excess mortality. That's the breast cancer CNBSS, the Canadian study, and that's the incidence, more cases treated and not meeting even at 14 years. This is the screened arm mortality, crosses over, and then you have a control arm up there and screened arm down there. So excess mortality up to here, then it has crossed over. Early surgery versus late surgery showing a difference. Exactly similar to what we had anticipated, that there should be, that early surgery is better than late surgery, but early surgery also induces some early excess mortality. That's the trial that we performed in city of Mumbai for cervical cancer. That's the mortality in the control arm crossing over, and excess mortality in the control arm by the time we went on to 7th year. That's the mortality in the screened arm, excess mortality for some years up to year 3, crossing over, and then saving of lives, early treatment versus late treatment. So very clearly, it's the act of observation that had all the impact on what should happen to the host. There is no question that early surgery is better than late surgery, because this is the data on no surgery till the patient dies. And if I were to never perform a surgery at all, I have barely 4% survival at 10 years. Whereas if I perform surgery, I have 68% survival. So early surgery is an answer, no question about it, but it is at the time of surgery. It's the act of observation that has made the difference, that decides is the cell metastatic, is the tumor metastatic, or it is not metastatic. So early surgery is superior to late surgery. Segregation between those who metastasize and those who don't is determined at the time of surgery by the act of observation and not prior to it. And this is an additional observation, that the act of observation is mediated probably through hypoxia. Since we know that about 451 different genes are either upregulated, downregulated by acute or chronic, by chronic hypoxia was known. We are showing it for the first time that it is the acute hypoxia that can induce a metastatic phenotype onto the primary tumor. So tumor changes from being completely vascularized to progressive devascularization, and tissue oxygenation drops precipitously during these 15 to 20 minutes, and cancer cells do get disseminated. There is now evidence that circulating cells show a huge surge during surgical intervention. Whether those are viable cells or not remains debatable, but there are cells. Can we tweak this event? So we have another trial which predated this experiment, since we knew that there was something happening in these tumors, that we ran 1,000 patient trial, 500 in each arm, and 500 women with early breast cancer received a depot injection of progesterone. Now, why progesterone? Progesterone is a hormone that appears in circulation immediately after ovulation. So, if a woman is going through normal menstrual cycle, then for the first 13 to 14 days, in presence of only estrogen, no progesterone, the follicles in ovary get ready. On an average, about 5 to 6 follicles get ready to extrude an ovum. What is remarkable is that the moment one ovum is extruded, there is a sudden stoppage of extrusion of ova, as if there is a switch that instantaneously stops movement of cells. And you can ask me, how do you know that? Because the incidence of dizygotic twins that requires two ova is extremely rare. It just doesn't happen. The sperms are in plenty, but you need two ova, two distinct ova. Identical twins come out of a single ovum. That's not uncommon. But non-identical twins need two ova, and two ova don't come. So obviously there is something that instantaneously stops movement of cells the moment one cell starts moving. Yeah? And what is movement of cell? Movement of cell is metastasis. Metastasis needs movement of cells. That's happening physiologically in every woman during every menstrual cycle, since menstrual cycle is preparation of pregnancy. And you cannot have ova coming in once the first ovum is fertilized. Then, all throughout the pregnancy is a state of high progesterone levels. Progesterones, if they drop, there are abortions. Recurrent abortions, one of the most important causes is lack of progesterone. So the treatment for recurrent abortions or threatened abortion is progesterone. We then ran a study to see, ask our pathologist that in a premenopausal cycling woman, regularly menstrual cycling woman, if I were to look at pap smear, will you be able to tell me that this pap smear is collected during follicular phase or estrogenic phase versus progestogenic phase? That came the answer. I don't have to look at the cells. I just have to look at the slide and I'll tell you this is follicular or this is luteal or progestogenic. The number of cells extruded by process of collection of sample from the cervix are about 1 million during follicular phase. And one has to search for cells from extruded cervix under the microscope. There are not more than 10 cells per low power field if the sample is collected during luteal phase. So there is obviously, this is an agent that increases cell to cell adhesion or stops cell motility. So we gave this injection 5 to 14 days prior to surgery, and so that's the schema operable breast cancer patients, 500 received this injection, 500 did not receive. All of them had standard surgery, all of them had standard treatment, adjuvant treatment, and they were followed up for 5 years, and that's the difference. A 10% difference in distant metastases and a 9% difference in deaths by a single injection of progesterone that cost 60 rupees. Suffice to say, this is the first randomized evidence that events at the time of surgery when tweaked can have a long-term outcome as far as saving of lives is concerned. We had a nice editorial that accompanied this publication, but what is important is that a progestogenic milieu at the time of surgery significantly improved both disease-free and overall survival in women with node-positive breast cancer. This could be a simple, inexpensive method. What is important, I'll not go into all the details, it's the events at the time of surgery that influence long-term outcome, as predicted by the RCTs of screening. And tumor can be pushed into complacency to prevent it from changing during the act of observation. So that's the application that I'm looking at, that act of observation might want the tumor to change, but if we can have some kind of a milieu which prevents them from the flight and fright response to be activated, we probably would remove the tumor. So I keep on telling my students that if you are doing surgery, remove the tumor before it understands that it's being removed. Call it a live organism that is ready to fly off. I will make just 2 or 3 slides more to make you understand what is the other impact of act of observation. I had mentioned to you the 2 numbers, X plus Y on both sides, and X plus Y is what should remain completely treated by the time you go to 10-year mark. Does that happen? So incidence of cancer and act of observation. The assumption, as I repeat the slide, X plus Y in screened arm, X plus Y in control arm, all treated here, some treated here, but somewhere down the line, 10 years, 15 years, all these will be treated and the numbers should come together. Does that happen? It doesn't happen. 10 years, it has not happened. Lung cancer also same. So we now know anywhere from 10 to 25 years of follow-up, and the excess numbers for breast cancer about 30%. This is a 25-year difference. 30% excess cancer after 25 years of randomization. Lung cancer, this number is 60%. Prostate, it is 70 to 90%. What's the implication in our day-to-day life? Implication is very simple. I'll show you some more numbers. This is the incidence of cancer in US versus India. These are 3 cancers which are screened in this country, not screened in India. The incidence of breast cancer is 30 per 100,000. Every lakh women per year, about 30 of them develop breast cancer in India. This number is 120 in the United States. This is age standardized. You may say that we are young, but this is age standardized. Lung cancer is 10 per 100,000, 70 in the United States. Prostate cancer, 4 per 100,000 in India. This is a figure which is a dream figure for United States. Bill Melinda Gates Foundation has put up about $2 million in Barshi because prostate cancer incidence is approximately 1 per 100,000 in that population. Breast cancer incidence there is 8 per 100,000 and it has remained 8 per 100,000 for last 25 years without any change. They want to know what is it that they can export from India to that place. The same incidence in United States is 60. What is remarkable is the states, Indian states, where at least one relative of a family is either in US or in Canada or in some other country. I'm talking about 2 states, Kerala and Punjab. In these 2 states, the incidence of prostate cancer is not 4. It's about 10 or 14 per 100,000. Only act of observation. I just want to say one last line. As I mentioned to you, that there is hardly any difference of saving of lives. In fact, we are killing more by doing screening. If there is no difference in saving of lives, by me detecting something early, my academic decision is I shouldn't be screening. So today, the committee for screening in United States has withdrawn prostate cancer screening in that country. They don't officially say that we're going to allow screening to be done. But we are in an era where health is served as a commodity. And if health is a commodity and I'm a person selling health, how do I define health? The frank word there is, I am selling immortality. I don't want patients to die. Yeah? Here is a situation, about 60% of the patients, I can't call them patients, they're actually ostensibly normal individuals, have cancer under microscope, proven by biopsy, which would have never manifested in their lifetime. Yeah? I want to treat only those. That person is neither going to die, but has cancer under microscope. I do that for 10 years. What happens then? I am looked upon as a doctor whose patients never die. Then I become the president of this country and I give as my election mandate, please have mammography, please have PSA. I do that for 10 years in a country. Huge number of individuals with a stamp of disease walk on the streets of my country. And they give me credit. I am the most successful doctor, I am the most successful president. And if this president then decides that I want to withdraw, he will lose his seat. Where is science? And where is the science that saves lives? In fact, it kills little more than what should have otherwise been dead. I would just repeat the final conclusions of my presentation. The most important conclusion is DNA is extremely sentient. In 15 minutes, 2,000 genes can go up and down, and in the next 15 minutes, they can come back to normal, allowing you to say that nothing has changed. The act of observation makes a big difference in incidence. It may be good for votes, but not good for life. Act of observation decides who is to metastasize or not, and this is exploitable in clinic for saving of lives. Thank you very much. I have exceeded my time.
Chronic hypoxia in the late stages, that doesn't lead to metastasis?
I had the slide, but I thought it would be too clinical about it. So, again, the advantage of being exposed to some other culture, how does that happen? When I left Tata Hospital in 1989, I had looked at previous 15 years breast cancer data. The average tumor size with which women presented at Tata Hospital was 7 centimeters in those days, 7 centimeters. And metastases at presentation, everybody had bone scan, liver scan and a chest x-ray, the same tests that were in those days happening in UK. The incidence of metastasis at presentation, no treatment given, but tumor allowed to grow from 2 centimeters or 3 centimeters to 7 centimeters. The incidence of metastasis was 9%. I looked at the Thames Cancer Registry data, wherein the average tumor size was 2.8 centimeters and the incidence of metastasis was 5%. But I treat a 2.8 centimeter lady with 2.8 centimeter, her chance of cure is 75%. I treat a 7 centimeter tumor, the chance of cure is 15%. So post surgery, only 15% of these 7 centimeter tumor will live, but I allow the tumor to grow from 2.8 to 7 centimeter, my incidence of metastasis grows from 5 to 9%. So there is obviously something allowing it to grow in vivo prevents or doesn't allow at least the metastasis to be manifested. Right. There are some studies to that effect. Longer the surgical intervention, greater is the mortality. But it could be many, many other things. Longer surgical intervention also suppresses immunity to a great extent, making a permissive environment. So if the cells are disseminated, they will grow. There is another study which I didn't, too much of data again. In individuals who already have metastases, the standard of care world over for years was not to do surgery for primary. But in recent past, some of the American hospitals were performing surgery even in these patients. So we ran a study that looked at giving chemotherapy to these patients after finishing 6 cycles of chemotherapy, randomize surgery versus no surgery. And in them, no difference in outcome because they were already metastatic. But the incidence of distant metastasis, growth of distant metastasis was much quicker in those who had surgery. That's the randomized evidence published in Lancet Oncology 6 months ago. That's the only and the first randomized trial.
Yeah.
Okay.
This progesterone experiment, how was it decided who gets the progesterone and it is randomized?
This is randomized. So there is a central randomization, a computer program. If I have seen a patient, I would call up the central number and the number has a random number table and that would tell me what to do. I was completely blinded to who will get what. We are looking at it. In fact, if you look at the pathways that lead to stem cells, there is a lot of sharing of genes between EMT and stem cell pathways. So I am sure there would be some signal, but we are looking at it separately. That's not part of this presentation. Right.
So, how would you regulate for what part of the tumor you take to do this analysis by
RNA? Usually, this is a central part of the tumor.
But
when I say central, can I write on this? So, if that's the tumor, my core biopsy needle will go right in there and I'll take that kind of core every time I do a biopsy. So it will be the center to periphery. I will have a core of tissue like that. But I would redefine this thought of a stem cell. Every cell has stemness and it toggles. Should I have that stemness expressed or not? And it will depend upon how hostile the environment, the microenvironment is. In places where we have chronic hypoxia in the center of the tumor, the stemness of the cells juxtaposed to that is maximum. So instead of saying that there are stem cells there and there are no some normal differentiated cells, I would say that the cells have this stemness in them.
Their chance of having metastasis was only marginally higher than the people, than the population, which had 2.8 centimeters. However, the chance of death is much larger. If it's only metastasis that causes the death, how is this correlated?
So,
not very much.
So, I am doing some test right now. These are liver scan, bone scan, CT scan as of today in a lady with 7 centimeter tumor and lady with 2.8 centimeter tumor. I have 5% metastasis in 2.8 and 9% metastasis in the other lady. I treat both of them when they don't have metastasis. That means I exclude those 5%, I exclude the 7%, 9%. The rest of the patients with that size tumor I treat because surgery is required for them. I follow them up in 5 years, I run the same test for detection of metastasis that I have run there, and I find that metastases have manifested before dying in more than 85% of women who were treated for 7 centimeter tumor and for barely 30 to 40% of them who have been treated with 2.8% tumor, 2.8 centimeter tumor.
Is the fact that to operate 7 centimeter large tumor, you had to do that intervention a lot more and therefore it created the metastasis?
The possibility of hypoxia is much larger in them. The access to various blood vessels is also bigger because the area is bigger. If 100 cells want to go out for them to be successfully seedling somewhere and producing metastases, then the possibility of 100 into 20 will go is much bigger because the surface area exposed to blood vessel is much bigger in a 7 centimeter. Volume wise, it is 7 by 7 by 7, whereas this is volume wise 2.8 by 2.8 by 2.8.
But if you didn't perform the surgery, then the survivability is really low.
Now that is about 10 to 12 years down the line. So people will have metastasis and die very, very later. So the rate at which metastasis will set in when left to itself will be much bigger. So it doesn't bite till the time you try to hold it, and it bites bigger later you hold it. That would explain what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's like catching a cat and trying to catch a tiger. Both will bite. One bite might kill us, the other may not.
You mentioned something about removing a certain layer of normal tissue which surrounds the tumor.
Yes. Yes.
Considering that there is a seepage of antigenic cells in the surrounding tissue. So how do you take a call on how much of tissue to remove? Considering it's just seepage, you have no idea as to how much.
So we typically would remove about 1 to 1.5 centimeters of surrounding normal tissue all around, and that will be studied under microscope to understand how far away the cells have gone. What is the second question? That question is very good. For a smaller tumor it will be 1.5 centimeter. For a bigger tumor I'll remove the whole breast, so I'll not even go closer than 4 centimeters. And for a further larger tumors, I might remove underlying muscle.
Yeah, that's one.
So the extent of surgery does depend on the extent of the tumor. Yeah.
So, yeah,
really early detection reduces the possibility that you let your cells metastasize.
Yes.
Then,
yes.
Then, I mean, it's really good to do early detection.
Yes. You saw the results that in women below 50 there is excess mortality. That's logical. What you're saying is logic. That doesn't happen in real life. In vivo systems differ very, very much compared to what my logic is. Logic goes out of window and I have to rely on data rather than logic. The reason is very simple. The reason is very simple. Lot more women will be picked up with that tumor and some of them will die. So if I am picking up out of certain number, I have only 100 women who have disease, late disease, 60 of them will die. I have another group wherein I have screened, that 100 numbers becomes 200, and in 200, 70 will die. When I look at the percentage, the mortality is 35% there, and here it is 60%. But the absolute number of women dying is a lot more there. And that's what is happening in United States and UK. For prostate, for lung, for breast.
So if during the surgery, hypoxia is actually responsible for metastasis, why can't you do something to prevent that? Or is the experiment that you did with progesterone stimulating thing, is something which actually prevented hypoxia?
No, it didn't prevent. It prevented response to hypoxia. It didn't allow the cell to change, to have the garb that gives metastatic potential. One can do with what you are trying to say, I can have a hyperbaric oxygen chamber being created and perform surgery underneath. Drug has to reach there. If I am denuding, the access of whatever I give is through the drugs. So if through the blood vessels. So if it is to prevent hypoxia, then there has to be some way of oxygen reaching there. Whereas if I were to prevent response to hypoxia, I could give that drug a day before. And the tumor is pushed into complacency. No, we didn't give it. My ethics committee refused to give distal water injection.
Experts knew that those surgeons who were operating on those patients
didn't know who had received the injection. They were blinded to it. But the endpoints are death. My measurement of endpoint can't be biased. Somebody is dead is dead. Somebody is alive is alive. So measurement of endpoint was so clear that it wouldn't have made any difference. That's why I agreed that let's not give placebo.
Sorry, I just wanted to know, when you say you've screened patients, is the screening, act of screening, an invasive kind of act? Or is it just, sometimes you can image or you do a prostate specific antigen test, etc.?
So prostate specific antigen test is quite an innocuous test. It's blood test.
Right.
But mammography is invasive. Mammography puts approximately 2 pounds of pressure between the two plates for the breast to be compressed to a thickness of about an inch. Then and then only I get a good picture for me to see the transparencies of tissues to diagnose a small cancer. That compression, I can share one more experiment with you which is not published, so I cannot vouch and say that. So what we did was collected blood sample for circulating tumor cells, then had the normal breast compressed for mammography. Both breasts don't get compressed at the same time. One breast gets compressed. Then I collected another sample of blood, and then the diseased breast was compressed for mammography. Then I collected a third sample of blood. And between the first and the second sample, there were hardly any cells that appeared. But between the second and third, there were a huge number of cells that appeared in circulation. We had a major problem getting that published, and the data remains unpublished. Because it is complete anathema to talk about against mammography in any of the Western journals. I mentioned the president would lose his seat if he talks against it. Who am I, a small fry?
If it's too small, you're indicating and creating a new cancer. If it is too big, it's too late.
No. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that even if it's a big tumor, it doesn't have metastasis that time. It's the act of surgery that will produce metastasis. The cure rates, even in late tumor, the data that I showed you there of the progesterone study, the average tumor size was 3.5 centimeters. and my cure rate is about 75% with progesterone. 75% of the women alive at the end of 7 years at 3.5 centimeter is not easy. So there are lots of modeling studies that have happened by two individuals, Maurice Tubiana and first name I forget, surname is Koscielny from France. And they have looked at various data sets of large databases to see what approximate size at which metastasis might have set in. And remarkably, the size was within the clinical domain. Heredity producing cancer, it's very small. Not more than 2% of the individuals have inherited cancers, breast cancer. You're talking about breast cancer? Not more than 2% of patients will have inherited breast cancer. 98% of breast cancer is sporadic cancer. And of these 2%, about one third of them or one fourth of them will have BRCA gene. The others have inherited cancer, but they don't have BRCA gene. They may have some other gene, which we don't know as yet. So actual BRCA positive women presenting with cancer and inheriting that cancer is a very small percentage in society. Extremely small, insignificant, as far as numbers go. But it will be a lot more in press. Thank you.
Sir, it's a great
pleasure.
I am Dr. Rav Pandey.
Oh, lovely.
This is one of the pictures that one of our students clicked. It's for you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.